This is Louise Sproul, and I'm here this evening with Gordon Fraser. Hello, Gordon.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for coming in tonight.
Yep.
We're really excited to have you here because you have just finished a book, and we're working on this book here with Review. It's called Song of the Spirit River.
That's correct.
You must feel pretty excited.
Yes, it's been a lot of work and a lot of typing to get it done. And it is exciting, interesting times.
And so I know that the book has six stories in it.
That's correct.
And maybe you can kind of tell us a little bit about the inspiration for those stories. Where have they come from in your head?
Well, the title story, The Song of the Spirit River was the Rouge River, and in earlier times, Indian times, it was known as the Spirit River. So that's where the title of the book comes from in that part. Other stories come from experiences I've had and opportunities I've had to visit around. I've been a tradesman in the area for many years. And as such, I've had the opportunity to visit people and their homes. And some of these places have gone back to the earliest of pioneer days. And as such, little bits gathered, bits of information here and there, had an interest in local history for a long time. Stories kind of come together. Some of them are logging tales from logger days. And tried to put a little bit of something in each story. It's a little different. In the short story format, gives me a chance to try different styles rather than one long book. And so that's basically where they come from.
Right.
My experiences in the mountains.
Right. And I find, for those listening, I should have mentioned off the top that you're from Grenville-sur-la-Rouge, and there's something very different. I mean, over here in Ontario, the land is flat, and then you reach the Ottawa River, and you drive across on the Long Sault Bridge, and then you see the mountains. Mm-hmm. And then when you drive up into the mountains, it's a different country. There's a river, and there's waterfalls, and there's twisty roads, and there are people living up there, and you just wonder how life is up there in the winter. And I know that some of the tales in the book are sort of mystical. There's kind of unexplained things in there without giving away too much. But life, I mean, it feels different over there. And you live over there, so.
Yes. It is more difficult, but it's. I think that's why people like living in that area, is because of that. It puts something into life when it's more than just getting up and getting on a bus. It's living close to nature and with the troubles and problems that go along, and kind of the joy and the community spirit that exists in those mountains and has for many generations.
And it's still there, too, like the Harrington Valley Community Center, when they want to do a fundraiser or something. They have a Greek carnival up there. They do a lot of activities. And you were mentioning before about the logging. There's a big logging history up there, isn't there?
Excuse me, yes. From my knowledge, the first official log driver, the first time logs or timber was actually taken down the Rouge was in 1808.
Whoa.
And it was at the time when there was Napoleonic Wars taking place. The British Navy was looking for timber, and there was considerable white oak in that area, so they started squaring timbers and bringing them down. The Rouge River was never very good for squared timbers. It is a little bit small for that, but they did for a few years while the Napoleonic Wars and while Britain was at war with America, too, in the War of 1812. Timber was brought over there for military purposes. After that, there was kind of a lull for a period of time. But then Hamilton started up in Hawkesbury, and then there was a mill in Calumet also. And these started putting on a drive or a hunger, an appetite for wood.
Right. There was a market for it. They were feeding these mills.
And Hawkesbury, the Hamilton Mill, was one of the largest mills in all of North America for a period of time. I mean, production-wise. And the mill in Calumet wasn't that far behind either. And to get their timber, they brought it down the Rouge in the log lengths and then gathered it up at the mouth of the Rouge and took it in rafts. At the Calumet mill that was only a matter of a couple of hundred yards downstream to the mill itself. But to get it across to Hawkesbury was a little bit of a trick because it was right above the Long Sioux Rapids there, too. And if something went wrong, all the logs ended up downstream and all messed up. But the mouth of the Rouge River itself was a sacred spot for the Indian tribes. They camped there from time immemorial to when they basically started to go extinct in this part of the world as tribes as such.
Right.
I believe the last battle between French and the Iroquois took place at the mouth of the Rouge River.
Oh my.
Approximately 1681, the Iroquois raided St. Anne just to the west of Montreal. And they were bringing prisoners and some goods up along the side of the river when they decided to pull in at the Rouge, the Spirit River, and to their campground and party a little bit. But then there were some voyageurs, French voyageurs, coming downstream. And when they saw what was happening, they decided to attack the Iroquois there, save some prisoners from very bad fate, and I believe it was the last time that French and Iroquois fought in this part of the world.
Boy, and how do you know all this? Where have
I'm a history buff. You know, along the way, and when it comes to stories like this, some of them, I was at a house in the McLeod settlement here in my time doing an examination on the house. And I found that underneath one part of the home was still part of the original McLeod, or one of the homes from that settlement. I can't say exactly which one, but it dated back to the very, very early days, late 1700s, when that settlement went together. And actually, just being underneath there and looking at that massive cedar tree that still had some of its bark on, and being that close to it, it's almost inspirational, you know, for my part to see it. And we're all humans, and as humans, everything comes from our mind or imagination before it becomes into reality. So when you see that, you think, well, there it was. Somebody was standing there in 1790 and decided to make a cabin. And the first thing they did was cut down a big cedar tree and lay it on top of some stones. Eh? And that still exists to this very day in one of these homes out there, similar to homes up in the Harrington and Avoca and our part. When I first moved into where I am now, there were several old cabins that were in very run-down state, but they were still there, and little roads off the Kilmar Road, all that's been wiped out now by the Highway 50, you know, and things.
Yes.
But nevertheless, and on my time, I got to meet a few of the people that grew up in there. So with that, and listening to people, and being interested, gathering stories where I can, diaries, letters, history books, little bits and this and that, and again, being a tradesman, sometimes it's work is a situation where you have time to think, because work is kind of repetitive.
Yes.
So it gives a chance to sort of form the stories in mind. But unlike you, I'm not really good on the typewriter. I'm very slow,
well,
and I find myself fighting the keys and the spell check.
You were pretty good. You brought, for our listeners, Mr. Fraser brought his first story for me to read, and it's the story that the book is titled after. It's called Song of the Spirit River, and I read the whole thing in one sitting, and it was just like it was a historical romance, but it just felt like a snapshot, like just a journey back in time. And I remember I sent you an email right away, and I said, this is really good, you know, and then it grew to two and three and four, and now it's six stories. And the other amazing thing that's happening is you've got an illustrator preparing, and I've seen some of the illustrations, some really nice illustrations to go with your book. Jill Crosby is working on them, and they're really, really nice.
Yes, she's doing some lovely, lovely drawings with pencil and paper. Yep.
And a map, too, eh? I think she's working
she's
on a map.
She's going to put a map on the front for people that aren't familiar with the area. So you'd be able to place on the map roughly where these stories take place. And all of these stories do take place within the region, a little bit in the Vanclakil-Dalkeith area, but mostly in the Grenville-sur-la-Rouge and the southern part of Harrington Township.
Right. And some of the names in the books, the names are familiar, but I guess you've changed things up a little bit, but the names... The place names, too, right? It's geographically... Yes. True, like it's in places that we could drive to, and we know.
I tried to fit historical names into historical places. The stories are set into history, but they're meant to be a fictional situation.
Right.
But some of them, like the Cuckoo Cache and the Song of the Spirit River, these are logging stories, and some of these things go back a long way. Men got together in their shanties and
told
and
tales,
told stories,
yes,
and compared situations, and there were legends that went around, and some of the characters in the logging industry were legend on themselves at the time.
Yes, yes.
In what they did and their travels. It was a hard enough time. You know, people lived, I found maybe only my take on it, but even though people in those days lived remotely and very much we would consider outside communication, and that there was a joy of living, a joie de vivre that seemed to exist. And although some of the travelers that might have met some of the people back there and say they weren't very, they might have taken the attitude that they were ignorant. I wouldn't, not being,
yeah,
but they didn't know.
No, I know what you mean.
But this was something taken by people who didn't really understand, I think, what they were looking at in the city, because
And they had a connection to each other.
Yeah, yes,
communities
exactly,
back
that
then
community
that maybe
spirit.
Yeah.
And that existed and still does exist very strongly in the mountains. It's been, like other things, destroyed somewhat, you know, with modern communications and that. But there was a very much of a community spirit. And like Vanclakil is still an excellent example of community spirit that's managed to carry on. And many towns have lost that. But people who live and come to Vanclakil always admire the place because of that community spirit. And the people knew each other from miles around up there, and you know the old stories of quilting bees and logging or barn building bees, where literally dozens of men and women would get together on one place and work for one individual and get that work done. Harvesting was done the same way, and when I was growing up Green Lane Road, it was similar. Men got together, families got together,
yes,
and did one farm, and then another farm, and another one, and people.
Is that where you're from? Are you from the Green Lane Road?
Yeah, my parents, my father had a farm there. Green Lane was called Fraser Avenue before it became Green Lane.
Oh, and I've read that somewhere.
Yeah, it was the very first farm on Green Lane was a Fraser. And a curious story there, because when he was leaving Scotland, he got to the boat, emigrant boat, and they were looking down the list as to who they were taking and who they, you know, the list of the
passengers,
trades and things that were needed in Canada. And farmers were needed. He was a tailor in Scotland.
Oh.
But when he got to the boat and realized there was no requirement for tailors, he wrote down farmer. And got over here, I guess, a little bit on false pretenses. But he was the first settler, and his wife, John Higginson, had passed that story on to me, how they wandered the land when they first arrived at their lot. And they spent the night at one camp, the first night on this one piece of rock land. And his wife said, this is where we're going to build. We're going to use those stones to build our house. And his house still stands. My sister pointed out that the old stone wall on Green Lane, which is in a little rough shape because of municipal almost underdigging it,
yes,
was a stone wall that was built by a tailor.
Oh.
Because he came as a farmer, but he had no experience
no,
really as
no,
a farmer other
no.
than observing. So he was quite a successful farmer and set up, and he built that stone wall fence that still stands along the front of Green Lane.
Wow.
As a tailor. I don't think he ever did tailoring again, though.
No way. Mr. Fraser, maybe you can read us a little sample from your book. And I think you're going to read a little bit of the first story in the book.
Uh-huh.
And the name of the story is?
Lewis and the Teacher.
Okay, you go.
Okay. Lewis McCaskill was 12 years old when his father went away for the last time. His dad had been going to work in the shanties and harvesting for as long as he could remember, but this going away was different. His father, Duncan McCaskill, had come back from a trip to Grenville, all excited. There was a war starting, and soldiers were wanted. Word was it was just going to be a short affair, something to do with fighting the Germans and punishing the Hun. Duncan told his son how he had fought the Boers when he was just a lad, and here was a chance for a quick trip and a little bit of pay. He should be back before Christmas. Duncan McCaskill never did return. Lewis's mother had died when he was just 10. Their family owned little as could be counted as wealth. Duncan McCaskill worked and tried hard, but bad luck had ridden along with him throughout his life. All the land grants from Grenville to beyond Harrington Township had long since been given out, and Duncan had no funds to buy, so he rented a log cabin off the Cedar Road beside Lake McGilvery. That's where Lewis grew up, living most of the time alone with his mother while his father went to whatever work he might be had. When his mother died, he became the keeper of the house at 10, taking care of the cabin and the chickens and the pigs, sometimes for weeks while Duncan labored. But the last time his father left, early summer 1914, he did not return. At the age of 12, Lewis had to take care of himself. When the snow set in and he had not the hay nor the bedding for two young cows and the horse his father had left him, he went to a neighbor and traded board for the animals in change for splitting firewood. That way he kept himself and his stock alive over the first lonely winter. He had gone to school when his mother was alive and sometimes when his father was in the house, but now all school lessons stopped and he became a man. Lewis McCaskill grew in stature and respect among the local community. By the time he turned 16, he was tall and strongly built with black hair and dark level eyes. He listened more than talked, and when he gave his word a task would be done, it was. From his first job of splitting wood, he went on to all forms of labor that might be needed from an honest, hard-working lad. From plowing to pulling weeds in crop fields to running errands for the lumbermen and cutting and storing ice, Lewis did it all, and he did it well. When coyotes scattered young stock, Lewis was a hunter of choice. He knew every nook and cranny of the mountains and could locate a young heifer after she gave birth in the fields and get her home, his soft manner almost always avoiding a scrap. The summer of 1918, Lewis was 16, 9 months old, and he was nearly certain that his father would never return. There had been not so much as a letter from since Duncan McCaskill left the cabin more than 4 years past. Lewis saw newspapers with descriptions of great fights, but he could make little sense of the names of the places. France, Holland, Germany seemed so distant, and he could not relate.
So thank you for reading from your book this evening. And one thing maybe we would like to let our listeners know is when do you think your book will be coming out? When would it be available for sale?
Well, I'm not sure exactly of how much time it takes from the time that we get it from here to publisher and back again. But that should be, to getting it to publish should be within the next month, I'd say. So with a little bit of luck, probably by end of September, maybe early October, it should be out and ready to go.
Yes, that's about right. And for those listening, actually, the review is working on Mr. Fraser's book. So you've got that schedule about right. And so I think we'll have that book for sale here at the review. And you'll probably, we'll have a story in the upcoming edition of the review. And we'll be letting people know when it's available. And have you got any words of advice for other people that might have a book sitting in a desk drawer somewhere? Is it worth going forward? Has it been a fun project for you?
Oh, yeah, for certain. Somebody that has a work in progress? Oh, by all means, yes, yeah. Because I'm no professional writer, but I do enjoy writing stories, and it's something I would never, ever know and even could do unless you sit down and give it a try. The first ones I did them the old-fashioned way with a pen and paper because I just was no good at a typewriter, but then finally settled down and... But yes, for certain, any kind of art that's inside a person, I think you should try it, bring it out. It's that idea that as above, so below, ideas form in the mind and then they come out into reality.
Into the world.
Everything is like that when we look around. Everything we see started as an imaginary item and then became reality into the physical world. And art is like that, writing, artwork. Jill Crosby with her wonderful drawings. If she had never tried, all that might have been lost. Others are similar. For certain, anybody that has that in them, give it a try. And
okay.
I highly encourage it, and I thank you for encouraging me on this too, Louise.
My pleasure. So we've been speaking with Gordon Fraser and his book Song of the Spirit River, which is a series of 6 short stories, will be coming out in September, and keep following the review or watch the review's Facebook page to find out more when that book is out and available. And in the meantime, if you do want more information, you can email me. I'm Louise Sproul. You can email lsproul@thereview.ca if you have any questions about Mr. Fraser's book or if you want to get on a list to be notified when it's available. So thank you for coming in, Mr. Fraser.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Louise.
Thank you.
And thank everybody for listening.